You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, Mark Pilkington from Stranger Tractor Press introduces a screening of Ken Russell's film The Lair of the White Worm, and then interviews a pair of BFI Flipside programmers about the film, its history, and how it fits into Ken Russell's oeuvre. After Mark's introduction, you'll hear a trailer for the film to give you an idea of what they were discussing.
Uncle Ken Russell's Lair of the White Worm is one of the later entries into his oeuvre, one of my favourites. And it's actually really hard to find. This is, as you'll notice, a DVD from America. There's no UK DVD, there's no print. There's a German DVD I couldn't get hold of. So it's quite amazing that as one of British cinema's great patrons, you can't find his films anyway. So this is, as you all know, part of Ken Russell Forever, put together by a great coming together of film clubs from around the city and brought to you by the same great people who put Scarlet Forever together, which Virginie, Electric Sheep, and myself. I'm Mark from Stranger Tractor, in case you want to know that. We put Night on here, and it's appropriate that I first saw this. And I'm thinking it must have been New Year's Day 1988 at the Scarlet Cinema when they used to show horror film previews on New Year's Day for people either young enough or tired enough not to have anything else to do. So anyway, film's 93 minutes, and then there's going to be a discussion with myself, Vic Pratt, and Will Fowler. And Vic and Will, you may know from the Flipside Nights at the BFI, and that will be also open to the audience to chime in, and we're particularly keen to hear your sort of memories of the film or even local lore that we might pick up on. But anyway, okay, we'll get started. Thanks.
Your time has come, Eve. Come here. You will have the honor of being sacrificed to Dionin alive.
There is a legend of an ancient evil.
Something's been found in Stone Rig Cavern.
A legend that no one would ever believe.
Legend has it that Stone Rig Cavern was the lair of the Dampton Worm.
Unless, of course, it came right up and bit him.
I hear you're having trouble with a snake.
Dionin was a pagan snake god.
I'm snake watching.
It's as if they were just swallowed up.
John Dampton went a fishing once, a fishing in the weir. He caught a fish up on his hook. He thought it looked mighty queer. Now what the kind of fish it was, John Dampton couldn't tell. But he didn't like the look of it, so he threw it down a well.
Ha! Well, you mustn't take the word worm too literally. It's an adaptation of the Anglo-Saxon virum, meaning dragon or snake.
The experience of a lifetime.
Now the worm got fat and growed, and growed an awful size, with great big teeth and a great big mouth and great big goggle eyes. So John set out and caught the beast and cut it into halves, and that soon stopped it eating babes and sheep and lambs and cats.
From the director of Altered States and the creator of Dracula, a new movie of venom and vengeance, Ken Russell's The Lair of the White Worm.
I'm famished. Should we stop on the way for a bite?
Watch out for your asp.
We'll just have a short discussion, and if anyone's got anything they want to ask or chip in, then please do. But I'll introduce Vic Pratt and Will Fowler of the Flipside, both archivists of the BFI.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed that. I hadn't seen it for 20 years.
You haven't seen it for 20 years?
No.
Well, I saw it the other day, but I must confess, before that, I hadn't seen it for 20 years, and it was... I remember it quite distinctly because it was a film, one of the films that, you know, when you used to get a film out on a sort of Friday night kind of thing, I would have been about 17 or 18 at the time, it was the late 80s. I remember getting that one out, and I must confess, the main reason I got that out was for titillation.
And were you titillated?
I was titillated. Because also at the time, I was in the Scouts. I was a Venture Scout.
A bit
at the
old
time.
For a scout.
No, I was the chairman of the Venture Scout unit. You know? And I have to say, there's a little bit of an inaccuracy there because the hat he's wearing is like a 1950s scout hat. I'd be quick to sort of point out that you didn't wear shorts like that. But I think that all fits in pretty well with this kind of how time is kind of, you know, the layers of time, just like the layers of Earth with the skull and stuff. Everything is out of time. There's all kinds of anachronisms in there.
Yeah. Well, he said that he wanted to update it and place the Bram Stoker story in the modern time. As you say, all the kind of visual players going through it all from different times. Even the policeman's car is it's kind of out of date.
And that's
the costumes.
Fitting for the...
Just
fitting for the story, because the film is loosely based on a 1911 novel by Bram Stoker, The Lair of the White Worm, also known as The Garden of Evil, which is itself based on a timeless, aka 17th, 18th century myth from County Durham, sort of
The Lambton Worm.
The Lambton Worm, yeah. Which is itself a story, well, it's set in the Crusades, period of the Crusades, so 11th or 12th century. And John Lambton is a kind of local rakish landowner who misses church one day, which is...
To go fishing.
Shocking, to go fishing.
It's a disgraceful thing.
And catches this little worm, throws it down the well, and a few years later, it's this giant thing which lives in the middle of the lake and eats animals and maybe even children.
The locals have to feed it sheep.
Yeah, sacrifice sheep to it. So we go to see a witch.
Yes.
And the witch says, here's what you do. Get a suit of armour, cover it in spikes or razor blades.
You can't just cut it, because it will join itself up again. So you have to cut it in multiple places so it can
split up. Wrap itself around the knight.
Because it's wrapped itself around a hill. Right. That's the first thing it does. When the worm grows, it wraps itself around a hill, and so you have pronounced earthworks around the hill. Worm Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what happens after
that? So he kills the worm, the sort of payment, the tithe for killing the worm, is he then has to kill the first living thing that he sees after killing the worm.
Yeah.
And he
also has to give 3 blasts on a hunting horn.
Oh, okay.
I believe.
Well, because that might be...
just to point that out.
We're getting there. So, he'd arranged for his beloved greyhound to be released.
That's right.
From its... pen when he'd killed the worm, so that he could then kill his greyhound, which would be sad, but not the end of the world.
Mm.
But instead, his dad appears.
His dad,
yeah.
It's all his dad.
And he refuses to kill his dad, and then the witch.
I think the dad did release the dog. I think his dad. They didn't forgot to kill the dog, and so a curse falls upon the family.
Yeah. There may be variations.
Did he kill his dad?
No, he refused to kill the dad. then there's a curse that no member of the Lambton family will die at home. And then he goes off to join the Crusades as kind of penance for screwing everything
and
up. Really.
Yeah, no Lambton will die restfully in their bed.
Yeah,
yeah.
And the curse continues to this day.
Yeah, apparently.
The current levels.
Well, funnily enough.
If you fed a child on junk food and for many years, and then you attempted to give it good food, like tasting honey or salmon, and the child spewed it up against, and this is filthy rubbish. I like McDonald's, thank you very much. Well, in a way, this educated system is being asked to look back at all these kind of cultish type taboos and what's the word for it? Superstitions, and going into detail, the snakes spitting at crucifixes and all this stuff, and cutting worms up or cutting people up, and vampires and Draculas and werewolves, all this nonsense which come from history, from noises that are heard in woods or forests and witches and all this sort of shite, you've been asked to look at it in detail at an age when we're close to World War III still, because there is something like 50,000 nuclear warheads in the planet on 9 different countries. So, I just kind of think it's a bit childish. It's kind of like to take it seriously at all, to even think it's funny in the end. It's like it's boring, it's childish, it's nonsense, and they ham it up. They don't even learn their lines properly. Sort of stuttering
I didn't understand this was your review of the film. we're trying to have a discussion.
Is what I'm saying. You're going into detail about this childish nonsense.
It's important.
Who wants to go into detail?
It's like
childish
Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall and it down to see if there's a secret code in it or something.
Everyone's a critic.
So, Mark, anyway,
we only wanted to talk about it for a couple of minutes. The film is
a contribution to a folk tradition. That was a really good retelling of the myth. I grew up with that story in the environs of Sunderland. The Lambton family were a Norman family, one of the sort of two big aristocratic landowners of Durham County. And they still own parts of Lambton Estate. This story has been, it's a folk story that's been retold numerous times. I think that the song that they sing is a 19th century musical song. You know, it's been reversioned constantly. I mean, you can pull up sort of versions from the 17th century. The sort of monster stories come round in books again and again and again. I just see that film as another contribution to this folk tradition. Yeah.
But what I want, you were going to tell us about the current Lambton.
The Lambton estate is now run kind of by proxy. Ned Lambton, the heir to the estate, lives in the Philippines, and he kind of runs the estate.
Which, case in point, the Lambton curse is still with him.
His
he won't die at home.
Was Anthony Lambton, who was a Tory MP, who not a long time before this was involved in a sort of hooker and drug scandal, an early tabloid sting. And Lambton Worm was used as a kind of a headline.
Layers upon layers of meaning. It all fits well with, like we're saying, the archaeological opening and the sense of cyclical time of Amanda Donohoe's priestess is this sort of eternal figure, the womb is this eternal kind of cyclical ouroboric keeps regenerating.
It's funny, I have this particular story that the film is based on, but you have other folk tales that feel very similar. So even like Hound of the Baskervilles, the Sherlock Holmes story with the ancestry and this kind of curse that resides over the family and this beast that comes back. And then even like Blood on Satan's Claw, the horror film, is sort of riffing on the same thing, of this thing kind of being dug up from the ground, having an effect on people.
And talking of Blood on Satan's Claw,
it's the same cinematographer.
Dick Bush, who I know got a tit in the room. Yes. It's like his sort of
it's a good name. Is it real?
It's a real name.
But he did Blood on Satan's Claw, and as I was watching it, I was thinking, that bit where they find the skull at the start is just like the bit where they find...
And you have to wonder if...
Is it a skull or is it a claw? It's the claw.
It's a skull with a worm, right at the start, with an eye.
This film to me is also an amalgam of loads of generations of horror films.
And
as well.
Presumably Ken Russell pulled in Dick Bush.
He'd worked with him over a number of other films as well, actually. Yeah. So they presumably were friends and worked together already. So, but
I'm still reeling that we're kind of investigating something that's a Humpty Dumpty film.
But again, that's drawing.
Maybe you should just say that film's good, that film's bad, and never say anything else.
Yeah. What do you think, then? Was it good or bad?
We can't say that, but it draws on
just sort of still excavating the layers. There's a lot of nature and ancient forces into buried in the ground, very Algernon Blackwood, Arthur Macken kind of vibes.
And very visceral, it's really kind of Humpty Dumpty, if you like, or cheeky and quite childish, but quite visceral and quite shocking, like those video sequences.
Yeah.
Feel quite full-on in a way, like with her sort of fellating the phallic objects.
Because I guess those video sequences at the time kind of looked clunky because it was like this new technology, and it was kind of like, you must, at the time, people kind of looked, it's a bit, but now looking at it, it looks kind of hip and cutting edge. That's what you put in an East End art gallery.
What goes around comes around.
Thanks.
So you were digging in the archives and you found some reviews and things from the time, which would.
My favourite is Film Comment, who in their article Wormomania said, I think this is their most pertinent comment, the story most resembles a very good episode of Doctor Who.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I noticed in the end credits that under the list of modellers, the guy who was listed first is Neil Gorton, who now does special effects for modern Doctor Who.
Oh, right.
They're pretty good. The worm itself is not.
Because I was thinking of the Doctor Who Kinder with the giant snake.
Yes, I was thinking of that as well.
That's around the same time. This is a little after that.
Mm-hmm. There's also Roger Ebert's Timeless.
Oh, yeah, Roger Ebert.
Yeah, very good. Timeless review.
Read that one out.
Can I read a quote from Ken himself?
Yeah,
a
quote from Ken.
From Film Comment. This is him talking about other filmmakers and having just made A Layer of the White Worm. So he's actually just been talking about Stephen Frears and Mike Colleen. He says, what they lack is eroticism. They want to deny the spirit and the flesh, and I think our job is to unite them. I've shown that through music written by people who experience that union, and music is the most visually inspiring way to portray that. My films are not biopics or social tracks. They're about the union of the spirit and the flesh, body and soul.
I wouldn't describe it as erotic.
I don't know.
You didn't get
quite saucy. It's titillating.
That's different. It's too camp. It's very, very camp. Quite panto.
Mona Donoghue's
camp
as present.
I found it satisfactory. when I rented it out in 1989.
Oh, yeah. Wow, it's not.
The Roger Ebert review, the Ebert rating is 2 stars.
Ooh, out of
he doesn't say out of how many.
Out of 2.
It's probably in the middle of something.
It's out of 4.
Out of 4, out of four. Okay, so he thinks it's okay. Let this much be said for Ken Russell's The Lair of the White Worm. It provides you with exactly what you would expect from a movie named The Lair of the White Worm. It has a lair, it has a worm. The worm is white, and there is a sufficient number of screaming victims to be dragged down into the lair by the worm. So he doesn't sort of say whether he likes it, but he thinks that Ken Russell provides you with your money's worth. Why he would have wanted to make this film is another matter. So, you know, he compares it to the old American international films of the 1960s. Yeah. And I think particularly notable in the pacing of it kind of harks back to an earlier generation of filmmaking, perhaps.
Which is refreshing. So you think of late 80s, horror film in the late 80s was really, even in this country, incredibly fast-paced, really frenetic.
Same month this came out, Hellraiser 2 came out.
Yeah, well, there you go. And those were just, no time to crack jokes or...
And even someone like, say, American Werewolf in London, which is kind of playing with the older gothic horror, the actual characters are very cynical and don't really sort of buy into the story, and then it kind of overtakes them. But although this is quite kind of ironic or silly, it's... The characters totally enter into what's happening and believe it, and it kind of has, although it's quite slow paced, it has this kind of trajectory where one sort of buys into it and it sort of shunders along at a nice pace.
And it's really helped by the clear levels of enjoyment that the cast are.
There must have been a great time part of this. Yeah, sure.
I think if they'd all been checking their watches after every scene to see.
Do you think they all enjoyed it though?
Did
Hugh Grant enjoy it?
Of course.
Yeah, he enjoyed it.
Do you know something I don't? Have you been talking to
him? He looked buff in the uniform, right?
Yeah. I did actually read that. I've forgotten her name now. The woman who played
Catherine Oxenberg.
She had a bit of a.
This was my main thought because she didn't want to do that scene naked. That's why she's in the white underwear.
Yeah.
Apparently she demanded silk underwear from Harrods, but the budget wouldn't stretch to it, so they had to get Marks and Spencer.
So she did enjoy it.
Yeah, but Ken in his biography says she looked very nice in it anyway. It's quite a charm.
Very tactful.
This is an interesting review. Now, Sight and Sound, which is that august periodical of the BFI, Kim Newman was writing the review of this film in there. He didn't like it at all. He says that Ken proves incapable of handling straight suspense, horror, or supernatural sequences.
I think he's missing the point.
Yeah.
It's not that film. You know, this is. I see this as comedy, not
It's the Wicker Man with a happy ending and jokes.
Yeah, exactly. It's panto. You know, it's panto. It feels like it should be on stage at Christmas and. Really? No, I think that's.
Some bits of it to me are effective shock moments. Mm. I mean, I like the bit where she sprays the crucifix, some of the bite moments are really good, I think.
The Hugh Grant slicing the mother in two is very nicely done as well. When everything goes sort of slow motion, and he becomes
the night for one.
I mean, does it work at all in any kind of? Is there any shock moments in there, or is it just me being an old fuddy?
No, you heard people going, ooh.
Yeah.
When the mother becomes the snake.
Mm.
Yeah, that's
really in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, one of my favourite scenes is the aeroplane. That's amazing. Just so funny.
This comes
out of nowhere.
The single most wonderful scene in history.
But it just comes out of nowhere. It's so
I found
unexpected.
With the scene that he's bringing up the pen, I found myself clapping. It was so amazing.
Can I point out Will was watching it on his own?
It's like you know it's going to happen, and it just keeps coming. It's so good.
Who would dare to insert a scene like that into if he was trying to make a serious horror film?
Yeah,
he wouldn't have. Yeah, those things wouldn't be happening.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, he had a 3-picture deal with Vestron, and they said they'd give him complete creative control, provided he didn't go over $1 million per film. And so he did a little, but he managed to get the final cut on it. So I think that's why we've got these kind of wonderful scenes.
Mm.
It's kind of like, you know, these little Ken Russell movies lurking inside this kind of genre piece.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that strikes me is considering how many phallic symbols we've got lying around in this film. You know, enormous penises drawn on the wall kind of thing, hose pipes, spaghetti, you know, worms. They're not content to just eat the worms. They have to have spaghetti when they're back at the hostel kind of thing. So considering there's all this phallic imagery in there, no one gets it on.
Mm. You know, this is kind of.
You think he might, but then he doesn't. You know, there's no one. You know, I wonder whether this is like the whole film is like a totem for lost virility,
or just very British.
Yeah, absolutely. It's totally building into that tradition.
The Boy Scout does get a blowjob, actually.
No, well, just saying. There's debate
about this a bit.
No,
it's a bit painful.
It may have been slightly painful.
But it's funny because at the beginning you think that maybe Hugh Grant, Eve, in inverted commas, had a liaison, but then later on it turns out she's
been dancing.
And they've been dancing.
Yeah. No, that's true.
It's all the teens.
And the thing with the relentless kind of innuendo is just visual innuendo to language.
Yeah.
It's really great and has this rich, I think, brings a richness to it that only someone as cultured as Ken Russell could have.
Yeah.
Could have brought to it, and then
he always gets away with this bawdiness because of all these other things that he does and the kind of transgressive qualities.
Mm.
And I've not seen The Fall of the Louse of Usher, but I really want to see that. But I always think there's this kind of idea that somehow Ken got more out of control, got more bawdy as his career went on. But I don't know if anyone's seen The Boyfriend, but that's very camp and bawdy, and lots of stockings again. I think he liked the stocking. That was his own fetish, I think. But that's 71, I think. So I think it goes through his whole career. I think that's part of the Ken Russell aesthetic.
There's sort of references to Wilde.
There's the Orson Welles reference, which is quite
the Welles. Sorry,
yeah,
right. That's what it says. Rose,
not
Wilde.
Yeah.
And Oscar Wilde with the Le Ponce being Ernest is in there.
Yes.
So there are all these layers of kind of that's also innuendo, really kind of cultural innuendo playing with.
Well, he's having fun, but
culture,
he's intelligent
exactly.
And can throw these things in without being pretentious.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Sort of seeming ridiculous.
But he is sort of like ripping off his own sort of like things. He's taking the mickey out of himself.
Yeah.
It's like, well, here we go. Here's the sort of like raped nuns and stuff like that. This is the sort of stuff that you would imagine Ken Russell will do. But he's sort of winking and saying, well, it's just fun. You know, this is just fun. I'm just having a lark.
But it's,
so it's quite self-referential in those ways.
Yeah.
Although those are such recurring themes. I mean, they're going to be in every... They're
exactly.
always going to be in the films. And again, I guess go part to his back to his own upbringing.
Roger Ebert in that review, he says, referring to Ken Russell, said, by his standards, it is rather straight and square.
Wow. Well, that's a funny thing. I rewatched The Devils last week, and your memories of Ken Russell films are always just nuns squirming and covered in blood.
Mm.
And actually, this reminded me as well that this and The Devils are actually quite talky, quite slow, quite stagey almost. And same with Gothic the other night, Gothic is faster paced than this.
I mean, watching this now, tonight, I realised that, as you say, it's very talky and it really does centre around the dialogue, which is funny because you see the early films, it's much more about the visuals and kind of cross-cutting and taking different camera positions and not always having dialogues for the story to unfold. So it's kind of unusual in that respect.
Mm.
And I think he actually wrote the script as well, which is quite unusual.
Well, the devils, yeah, again, that was, I thought, you know, things revolved around
the dialogue
and the exchanges and the sort of tension between characters rather than just endless squirming.
Yeah.
I mean, this is quite conventional at first, isn't it? And you think it's going to be more of a straight genre piece than it is, and then as soon as you're into the video graphics and the Romans are coming through, you know, wow.
You wonder if there are hours of unused sort of video graphics scenes.
Yeah.
Could make a whole film out.
He probably has it.
Yeah. Anyone else?
It's quite funny to look at it now from there. If you think of it as Amanda Donahue as the witch queen of the 80s, Margaret Thatcher, bites Peter Capaldi creates Malcolm Tubby.
Yeah.
As in his current war against the tabloids becomes the Toxic Avenger.
That's amazing.
It's a crystal ball moment.
I mean, that's one incredible thing. It's actually the cast is the kind of almost the cream of respectable British acting talent of a few years down the line are all brought together. How? Why? For this one film.
I really would like to know what Hugh Grant thought about making this, or even if he had a good time now, what he thinks looking bad.
Yeah, because he wasn't a celebrity at all at this time.
Not at all.
No. And none of them really. Amanda Donahoe was the only person who anyone would have sort of recognised, I think.
Catherine Oxenberg, she was in Dynasty.
Dynasty,
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, well,
but it's kind of, you know, you've got the Merchant Ivory films, kind of.
They were coming
more.
Some
have been made, but sort of becoming increasingly famous, and that sort of played the, you know, this one plays on the sort of romantic stories, but obviously takes in a very different direction.
And the sort of palatial manor house settings, and you know that it does have a anti-toxin to Merchant Ivory in some great locations with the big stone arch is amazing as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I
can tell you. Elstree, mainly shot at Elstree, but then in the Peak District.
Where was it?
Staffordshire.
Right.
Apparently The Verve shot their first album cover there. So if you want a double pilgrimage, you can go and visit.
Elstree, Nebworth, and Gaddison Place. That must have been one of the other houses. Maybe that was her temple. Because Hugh Grant's house was Nebworth, the home of Bill Whitton, who was a Victorian fantasy, gothic, science fiction writer. That's Nebworth House.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So Amanda Donahoe's must have been Gaddison Place.
Just to say that all the critics, generally, this is one of those things that I'm sure sort of accepted parlance now would say that everyone hated it at the time, but they didn't, you know. We've sort of done a fairly reasonable trawl through the reviews, and
as we say, Kim Newman's pretty scary.
Kim Newman's
thing,
about
that's
the
kind
most
of the
negative.
Exception.
Yeah.
Because he was a young upstart at the
time. He was a young
He knew how he wanted his horror.
Yeah. Actually, The Cave, sorry, I have got that here. It's called Thor's Cave, brilliantly enough. Also, Thor's House, Cavern, another name, or Thorisus's Cave, and it's a natural cave in the manifold valley of the White Peak. What a great name. In the Peak District, in Staffordshire. So, Thor's Cave, if you want to go there. Yeah.
Variety loved it.
Does anybody ask him what he thinks of it?
No, should do.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if he...
I bet he changed his mind.
He's still sulking.
Yeah. It does stand up, you know, given the just hearing people laughing and squirming and...
Only one person sort of complained.
One person. Humpty Dumpty Man. He didn't.
What do you reckon? Does it stand up? You know?
It was at the time where maybe you would have been confused as to whether it was supposed to be horror.
Well, I felt the same as Kim Newman when I first saw it, but then I was 13.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought, I want my horror straight. There shouldn't be any jokes in there.
I think also at that time, horror was also seen as a bit of a joke. It was all a bit Freddy. It was all everybody was having a laugh. It was all a bit postmodern. And no one was doing a serious, sort of like scary film.
First Hellraiser.
Hellraiser 2, yes.
I mean, compared to 2, I don't think it's fair to say that Hellraiser 2 was lighthearted.
Fair enough, but it was quite, you know, that was quite an anomaly at that time. American horror, during that particular period, was quite referential and quite comedic. Sort of like the villains were becoming like Freddy eyes. Kind of like,
Why is cracking? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that at that time people just wanted something that was serious, scary, and direct.
But that wasn't it.
Entirely self-referential and a hell of a lot of fun. I think it's so much more fun now, really.
Mm. It's distance, right? Distance makes it better. Yeah. Is that true to say?
I felt almost exactly the same as I did 20 years ago watching it. Just
why
my knee
hurt. Why do you think you made this film?
It's a good question,
You've got the line, I was just sick and tired of things Victorian. I've done so many costume dramas, I thought, the hell with this. I haven't done modern times. that's why I did it. And he was interested in the Lambton Worm song, which he researched in Cecil Craig House.
But it's so funny, just thinking about the kind of him going, you know, working with the contemporary, but having these sort of layers of myth and time and thing. It actually, in some ways, in terms of what it resonates most with from that time, is probably children's dramas, things like Boom Dial and stuff, which is not so much scary, but using the contemporary term.
It's quite Enid Blyton with all the sandwiches and tea.
The policeman, that car.
And the success of Gothic meant that he suddenly got this new contract for three more films.
Well, I wonder actually, because I think the success of Gothic was mainly from video sales in the States. So I didn't know whether the expectation was maybe that it would work well in video, maybe more than the cinema.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And Vestron, I always remember their big V logo being a video thing. But whoever said that, it's very much true. There's a lot of comedy of manners in there. Everyone's kind of being frightfully English and polite to...
Being aimed at the American market, it's the only reason why you could think of Ken Russell saying to Hugh Grant, play it posher than...
And there's a constant, I wouldn't say tension, not exactly, but there's a constant playing off reserved banality of sort of British life and then... You know, Amanda Donahoe's timeless ancient pagan virility cult, serpent worshipping cult, those things are constantly playing off each other.
And all the way through this seemingly heterosexual context, and then at the end, suddenly the two guys in the car together. The kilt is...
It's all quite confusing, isn't it? I was just confused. I didn't like it.
I was confused. We'll have a chat. I was confused because Hugh Grant, he's on the phone, right? And he's just about to get bitten on the leg. And then we don't see... So had he been bitten at the end?
Were they
both bitten? Because Mum was on the floor.
Something like, I wouldn't sort myself out in prison, would I? Something which was slightly...
Amanda Donahue with the sort of strap on as well, and the images in the wall, and then it's like there's this whole thing that she is the worm, but then later she's kind of the acolyte of the worm, or she's the
she's been immortal up to this point.
Yeah,
but the thing is, it's just it's kind of, it doesn't matter in a way, because it's the excuse to get her in a basket so she can do a sort of thing.
I wonder how many takes they did of her kind of working around.
Just one.
I think she think so. Yeah. She knew what she was doing.
She was a hero. She does carry
channel
the whole
film. She carries her film.
Yeah.
Totally.
The policeman dancing was quite
stiff, almost robotic.
He's great. He was a familiar face. But like, don't know where from exactly. Definitely from Amicus.
Yes,
of course. That's where he's from. Yeah, he must have done a lot of TV. So any other thoughts? Otherwise, we've got what else is coming up? Ken Russell Forever. There's Listomania on Saturday, The Gate in Notting Hill. If you like palaces, you'll love Listomania. There's Savage Messiah on Friday at the Montpellier. I don't know where that is. BFI. Showing all sorts of TV stuff.
In the media tech.
In the media tech. So you can just go in
all
and
look at it.
All the
monitor things you can go
into.
Well,
I was just reading today about Ken Russell's documentary about Bruce Lacey.
I'm doing a Bruce Lacey project at the BFI, and he made a 50-minute film about Bruce Lacey.
That's right,
which
so it's
was
not a full-length film.
No, so it would have been like a kind of item within the Monster programme.
Right,
but it's the next one he made after The Pop Goes the Easel film, which is one of his sort of more famous Monster films. But
is that film going to be on the Bruce Lacey?
Well, it's hopefully going to be on this Bruce Lacey DVD that we're doing the BFI, but because it's clearing television stuff is really complicated, and so it is going to be on, but we hope that it will be. So it's really terrific.
There's a big retrospective about his work, the Performing Arts Centre.
Yeah, so there's going to be a show of all his artwork at Camden Arts Centre, and then we're showing quite a lot of his films and related work at the PFI at the same time. So we're definitely showing the Bruce Lacey film the Ken Russell film within that season, and hopefully it will be on DVD as well. So.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Vic Pratt, Will Fowler. Come back soon.
For more information about the BFI Flipside, please go to www.bfi.org.uk/flipside.html. And for more information about Strange Attractor Press, please go to www.strangeattractor.co.uk. For more information about Electric Sheep events and other podcasts in which you'll hear interviews with directors and filmmakers, please go to www.electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events. And on the website, there are a variety of reviews and articles about Ken Russell to go with this month's season of Ken Russell films that are screening throughout London. The Electric Sheep podcast was edited, introduced, and recorded by Alex Fitch, and there'll be a new episode online next month. Thanks for listening.